Great to be with you today. I'd like to talk with you about one category of those people that we come across every day. This was prompted by something that was said downstairs as we were eating a time or two ago when I was here. There's a certain category of people that are mysterious to us, that sometimes they might even enter into our assembly as strangers to us and do some things or say some things that seem odd and that we hardly know how to deal with. This category of people, we would generally say, are those who suffer from mental illness. This is a big subject, and I hope it's not too heavy of a subject for this particular time. I don't think it is. In fact, with fewer of us here than ordinarily, it may be just exactly the right time to talk about this, because maybe you are the strength of the congregation. Mental illness is, these are a group of brain disorders that can cause severe disturbances in thought and feeling and relating to other people. They are so severe that sometimes they cause an inability to cope with the ordinary demands of life. Mental illness exists throughout the world. It exists in every country and every culture. And it exists regardless of custom or race or religion or economic condition or child-rearing practices or political orientation. We've been struggling to understand mental illness for centuries, but we haven't been very successful in this. People suffering from mental illnesses have experiences that are quite different from the rest of us. Sometimes they can't distinguish reality from their own fantasies. Sometimes their perceptions of the world are grossly distorted. Sometimes their moods swing dramatically from one extreme to the other. And when symptoms persist in a severe and disabling way for long periods of time, we consider these to be caused by two groups of psychiatric conditions. First, there is schizophrenia, and then there are the major affective disorders. These are the two general categories. These are the most serious forms of mental illness. Schizophrenia is the worst of the mental illnesses, and the major affective disorders are things like bipolar disorder. This used to be called manic depressive disorder, but a lot of people thought that was maniac instead of manic, and so they changed it to bipolar disorder. This also is where severe depression would be categorized. These things on this side over here deal with issues of mood, whereas the schizophrenia is, and really we should call these schizophrenias, because just like there are many different kinds of cancer, there are many different varieties of schizophrenia, different categories of it. But these are all issues thought. So that's what makes them different from one another. These have common symptoms. They respond similarly to certain treatments. They have somewhat predictable courses, somewhat predictable outcomes, but there are still many, many differences under these schizophrenias. There are hallucinations. There are delusions sometimes that are a part of this. A hallucination is a sensory experience perceived seemingly by the senses, and yet it's not caused by an external reality. The most common hallucination in an unmedicated schizophrenic person is hearing voices that don't really exist. Sometimes they see things that aren't there. Sometimes they feel things that aren't there. Sometimes they even smell things that aren't there. But in generally, it's the hearing of the voices. And these things seem just as real to the hallucinating person as sitting here right now seems to us. The voices that they hear may say things that are insulting. They may say things that are demeaning to the person hearing them. They may tell the person who is hearing them to do things as well. Sometimes they cause the person to smile or to laugh in circumstances that seem inappropriate to the rest of us. Whereas a delusion is a false belief. Many people with schizophrenia believe that people they see on TV are talking directly to them. People with paranoid schizophrenia sometimes believe that other people are trying to harm them. Many of the delusions have religious themes involved with them. To hear a schizophrenic give his or her interpretation of a passage in the Bible can be a mighty bizarre experience. Even if a schizophrenic holds two contradictory delusions at the same time, you won't talk him out of either one of them. You can explain to him that. Can you see how, if this is true, this can't really be true because it contradicts? And the person will say, yeah, but I still believe them both. It's just a part of the package. Schizophrenics in general are overstimulated by their own internal chaos, and some of them react by withdrawing into their own quiet place, or they feel confused and overwhelmed when they're around people, especially around large groups. Sometimes they feel like their life is spent walking in a dream. Things happen without the usual logical progression. Some of you undoubtedly some years ago saw a movie called A Beautiful Mind that was released in 2002, but it was a famous movie. It's an account of the life of the schizophrenic mathematician John Nash, starring Russell Crowe as Nash. I read that book a number of years ago and found it to be much better than the movie, as well as being more accurate than the movie. There was a statement made in that book that Franz Kafka's novel, The Castle, is probably the most compelling rendering of the schizophrenic consciousness in all of literature. I think most of you here, many of you here, have read something by Franz Kafka. The Metamorphosis used to be assigned in school, and maybe still is, where the protagonist is transformed into a giant insect. That might sound familiar to you. Or you may have read The Trial or The Penal Colony or some of the short stories of Kafka. Everything Kafka wrote is related and somewhat similar to everything else he wrote. But when he died in 1924, he left this novel, The Castle, unfinished, with instructions that all of his writings were to be burned after his death. But The Castle was published a couple years after that, and it is pretty bleak. I can see why the author of A Beautiful Mind would call it a rendering of the schizophrenic consciousness. If you read that book, it seems like you're experiencing some of that. Now, in the major affective disorders, the main symptoms have to do with, as I said, disturbances of mood rather than so much disturbances of thought. Moods are disturbed if they're too up, manic, or if they're too down, depressed, or if they alternate back and forth between the two. The two most common major affective disorders, as I said, are bipolar and major depressive disorder. With bipolar, people have episodes of feeling manic and at other times episodes of feeling depressed. In the major depressive disorders, then people have periods of extreme depression only. In both bipolar and major depressive disorder, people have periods of time when their moods are relatively normal, and then patterns just change enormously from one person to another as to how long the episodes last and how frequently they occur. I'm thinking of one young woman right now who part of the time she seems just absolutely normal, and then the other time she can't leave her apartment, she doesn't return your phone calls, and she's in a very bleak circumstance. And she alternates back and forth between these. In order to we're talking here, all of us know people that we consider to be moody, but that's different from having an affective disorder. To have an affective disorder, the moods must be extreme and influence extensively the way you live your life. Or the depression must be so severe that eating or sleeping patterns are seriously disturbed, or the person is so lacking in energy or interest that they can barely do anything at all. And there are feelings of worthlessness and hopelessness and helplessness abounding in these people. Severely depressed people may have great difficulty concentrating, great difficulty making decisions. They may feel that they should think about suicide sometimes. In fact, 10% of people with schizophrenia and severe bipolar disorder, in fact, do ultimately end their own lives. Depression can reach a psychotic level when the feelings lead to delusions, that is, believing things that aren't true. I have known people, for instance, who thought that they were responsible for a tornado that happened and killed people. Or they were responsible for somebody who died in a car wreck hundreds of miles away and whom they hadn't talked to for months. But they're responsible for that somehow, and they really believe that. People in a manic state have moods that are so elevated that they often do things that are very inappropriate. They talk fast in a pressurized way. Their thoughts race from one idea to another. They don't sleep much. Their eating patterns may change. They spend lots of money, whether they have it to spend or not. They're easily distracted. They may have grandiose delusions, believing that they are superhuman or that they have special powers of some sort. This is a description of the mental illnesses as we know them in our time. Now, what is it that causes mental illness, and who is likely to get it? Until recently, the ways of studying the brain were quite limited. The main thing that we could do until recently was just perform autopsies on the brains of cadavers, and obviously you don't learn much from that because it's hard to study how the brain works when it's dead. But now we can do MRI scans, magnetic resonance imaging, and we can do PET scans. We can make three-dimensional pictures of living brains while they're involved in various activities. We can see clear differences in the functioning of the brain, whether it's a normal person compared with those who have schizophrenia or Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or what have you. Genetics has helped with this too. We've located key chromosomes and genetic markers in people with bipolar disorder, and we can trace these on family trees. So we're learning. Nevertheless, we still don't know much about mental illness, but we're learning just a little bit. What we don't know still far outweighs what we do know, but we're learning just a little bit. Most of you know, I think, that Lynn and I have a son who is afflicted with schizophrenia. When we first got that diagnosis years ago, I thought, well, if we can just learn everything there is to know about schizophrenia, maybe we can fix it. But part of the learning was that we know almost nothing about schizophrenia. These are the most complicated problems in medicine because they're dealing with the brain. That makes them far more complicated than diabetes or heart disease. Nobody knows yet exactly what causes mental illnesses, and worse, nobody knows how to cure them. Nobody knows how to predict in whom they will develop entirely. We do know, though, that heredity is apparently the most important factor in determining who is likely to develop them. The evidence for this is quite substantial. The chance of your getting schizophrenia depends on how many and which of your relatives had or have it. If nobody in your family has ever had schizophrenia, then you have only a 1% chance of getting it. That's still pretty high, you know, 1 in 100 people around the world, in developed countries, underdeveloped countries, doesn't matter. 1% of the world's population, evenly spread around the world, develops schizophrenia. That's the occurrence in the general population of the world. Between 2 and 3 million people in our country have schizophrenia. Many more than that suffer from bipolar disorder or severe depressive disorder. But if you have a second-degree relative, like a first cousin or a grandparent that has schizophrenia, then instead of having a 1% chance of getting it, you have a 2% chance of getting it. If you have a first-degree relative, like a brother or a sister or a parent that has schizophrenia, your chances of getting it jump to 10%. If both your parents have it, you've got a 40% chance of being schizophrenic. If you have an identical twin with it, you have a 50% chance of being schizophrenic. If you have several relatives with it, then you add up the percentages that go with each of those relatives and come up with your percentage chance of getting it. We have followed the histories of children whose biological parents had schizophrenia and who were adopted by people who did not have schizophrenia. We followed the histories of adopted children who were born to non-schizophrenic parents but were adopted by people with schizophrenia. And the outcomes favor statistically they favor the biology, not environment as the cause. 10% of those who were born to a parent with schizophrenia developed schizophrenia, even though they were raised by normal parents. 1% of those born to normal parents and raised by parents with schizophrenia developed the illness, which is just like being in the general population. Studies of identical twins who were adopted and raised separately show the same thing. 50% of those whose twin developed schizophrenia developed the illness themselves. We know that the primary cause of bipolar and severe depressive disorders is physiological and not genetic. We've got a lot of evidence about what does not cause mental illness. In time past, many families have felt that maybe drugs or alcohol caused their relative to develop mental illness. And while that could possibly be true in some cases, there are certainly millions of people who used and abused drugs and alcohol who never developed any signs of schizophrenia or major affective disorders. Most people who are starting to develop symptoms of mental illness, or many of them turn to drugs or alcohol at some point just to escape from the discomfort and fear of what is happening to them. In essence, what they're doing is trying to medicate themselves, because here they are locked into a body. They know that something's wrong, but they don't know what it is. They go into their closet and they cry out to God and ask why, and there seems to be no answer forthcoming. Does God cause mental illness? Absolutely not. Was there any schizophrenia in the Garden of Eden? Absolutely not. Genesis 1:31 says God looked out over what he had made, and it was very good. That means it was the best of all possible worlds. But we do know that there are over 1,500 harmful genetic mutations in our human gene pool at this point. These are directly and indirectly brought about by man. We have filled our school buildings with asbestos years ago before we knew better. We painted our houses with lead paint before we knew better. We dumped Agent Orange on our soldiers. We spread DDT all over the ground. We gave thalidomide to pregnant women. And on and on and on, as you know. God didn't cause the problems that come about from the things that we did. God didn't cause mental illness. And God loves everybody who is mentally ill. While there is no known cure for these serious mental illnesses, what we can do for many people is to reduce the severity of their symptoms and improve the quality of their life. And we do this through the use of medication. That's the best that we can do at this time. The most significant consideration is which medicine to try first. And unfortunately, the only way to tell which treatment is going to help most people is just trial and error. Why some people are helped by some treatments and others are not is not yet known. Nobody can predict who will or will not be helped by a certain treatment. Success is probably related to individual physiological differences within the body. Unfortunately, it can take years to get the right combination of medicines in the right dosages, and then things can still change as the body becomes used to the drugs or because of the progression of the disease itself. So you have to have continuous monitoring in the usage of these drugs. But I stress to you that the single most effective form of treatment for most people with a major mental illness is medication. About 80% of schizophrenic people are helped by medication, at least to some extent. And the affective disorders, like bipolar and major depression, tend to respond to medication much better than schizophrenia does. If a person has a major depression or a bipolar situation, they have a very good chance of being helped quite a lot by the medicine they take. In fact, many people with the affective disorders, like bipolar or major depressive disorder, they lead very full lives. These people can, in most cases, they can work and have families and friends and enjoy themselves, and they're able to do almost everything that they would like to do. And many of the people that they have contact with in their lives never even know that they're taking medication or that they suffer from a serious mental illness. The medications are that helpful. 80% of people with bipolar find that medicine eliminates or minimizes the mood swings. Jesus Christ said that sick people need a doctor. By that, I take him to mean that sick people not only need to be seen by a doctor, but they need the medicines that the doctor prescribes, whether it was in the first century or the 21st century. Needing a doctor includes the medications that the doctor prescribes. We should thank God that he has allowed us to isolate and discover the medicines that we have. Previous generations did not have most of these new generations of drugs that we have now. Previous generations, in some cases, actually had to lock their mentally ill relatives up to keep them from hurting themselves or other people. When Patrick Henry said, "Give me liberty or give me death," his wife was at home in chains, literally in chains, because there was just no known treatment for her condition, and you didn't want her to run off in the woods where you couldn't find her. You didn't want her to hurt herself, so he had to chain her up. Prescribing medications for people with mental illness is far from an exact science. It's often a hit-or-miss process, but the biggest problem is not that. The biggest problem with the medication is getting people to take their medicine. Many will take it for a while, and then over time they do begin to feel better because the medicine has a good effect, and then they say, well, I feel good. I don't need this medicine. I feel just fine. A lot of people don't like the side effects of the drugs, and who can blame them for that? The sleepiness, the lethargy, or whatever the side effect is. Or they'll say, I just don't feel like myself when I'm taking this drug. So they feel like the benefits don't justify the side effects. Because people want to feel normal, especially young people who are afflicted with these illnesses. They want to feel normal. So they take themselves off the medication and then they go right back to where they were before they started. And if they're ever going to get better, they have to climb that medical mountain all over again. So these people and their the families and friends that are trying to help them are kept on a roller coaster. Go to the top of the mountain, go to the bottom of the mountain, back and forth. Go off the medication, and a couple months later they feel like they're losing their mind or they're in the process of deciding to kill themselves. So they go back to the hospital, they get back on the medicine, and then they climb the hill all over again. It's extremely difficult for many people to accept that they actually have a mental illness. They go into denial, which is the usual reaction to any shocking bad news that we get. We'll say, no, that can't be right. And it's the same thing if I tell you you have a severe mental illness. So they grieve the loss of some of their dreams. They grieve the loss of their ability to have a normal life. As one nurse said to me one time, he wants to be a normal 21-year-old, but he's just not. Accepting that you have a mental illness often means acknowledging that your life is going to be different than you hoped it would be. And some people believe that if they can survive without the medicine, then that proves they're not a mental case after all. So there are all sorts of emotions involved in this. Now, what about us as Christians dealing with mental illness? If we develop a mental illness ourselves, but more likely with this group, I think we're talking about dealing with mental illnesses in the people who are around us, our friends, our loved ones, our children, our parents. Many around us have mental illnesses. How do we help out with that? How do we live the Christian life in such a way as to be helpful with that? Whether it's your own mental illness or that of somebody that you love. The first thing we do is apply the golden rule. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Treat that person like you would want to be treated if your roles were reversed. Listen very carefully to them. The sick person needs to know that people are taking his or her concerns in a serious manner. Before the person can take medication, they have to be willing to talk to a doctor who is the only person who can prescribe it. And just getting somebody to a doctor can be a challenge sometimes. They'll sometimes say, I'm not sick, I don't need any help. Get the name of a doctor who is good at dealing with mental illness, and I don't think there are a whole lot of them around. But get the name of a doctor who's good at it by asking people who have a friend or relative who's been treated for a similar condition, or ask somebody in the medical profession who they would send their sick relative to. There are online sources for finding a good doctor as well. It's good for the doctor to have experience with the same kind of illness for which the person that you're concerned about is suffering. Ask them if they've worked with people who have your relative's condition, and if so, how extensively have they worked with them and how successfully have they worked with them. It's important for there to be a good rapport between doctor and patient. You don't want a doctor who's going to expect too much, and you don't want a doctor who's going to expect too little from the patient. Early detection of these mental illnesses is a very important thing. Once you're sure that this person has a mental illness, then the earlier they start the medication, the better. Don't trivialize the discomfort that's caused by the side effects of the medicine. We do have medicines to help deal with the side effects as well as with the illness itself. But try to point out the benefits of taking the medicine. Create a way, if this person is living on their own or even under your care, create a way for the person to know each day when to take the medicine and whether he or she has indeed taken the medicine on that day. Some medications can be obtained in a long-lasting injectable form. Just get it shot into your leg once or twice a month, and then you don't have to worry about taking that particular medication the rest of the time. An illness that begins later in life may be less severe overall. Schizophrenia may commonly begin, though, early in life, in late adolescence or early adulthood. For males, schizophrenia usually begins in adolescence. It's called adolescent onset schizophrenia, starting in the late teens or early 20s. Our son Dylan was in his teens when this began to show up in him. He was deteriorating, but we didn't know why, and he didn't know why. He just knew he didn't feel right. We just knew he wasn't like he used to be and was falling behind the peers that he used to know. For girls, it's usually a little later, mid-20s to early 30s. Some of you, if not a lot of you, know Eldon Cox, lives in southern Missouri and in Colorado now. His first wife was schizophrenic, but it didn't come on her until she was 30. Bipolar can appear at any age, but it's likely to be more severe if it appears in adolescence or early adulthood. It rarely develops after the age of 35. The prognosis for these diseases is better if the symptoms just come on the person all of a sudden. The illness is likely to be more severe when the symptoms just develop gradually, little by little, over time, over a long period. So how do we help? How do we deal with this? One thing we need to do is learn to make peace with whatever limitations these illnesses impose on the lives of our loved ones. It's not like we have much choice anyway. So we might as well learn to make peace with that and learn to enjoy whatever good times there can be and learn to appreciate the abilities of these people that do remain intact and try to feel good about any steps that can be made in a positive direction. It's good to allow people as much freedom and as much responsibility as they can handle, recognizing that they are not always the best judge of how much freedom they should have. Mental illnesses are different from many others in this respect. What people do in the midst of a psychotic break when the illness is at one of its epic points, they don't always even remember. Your feelings may be hurt by some outrageous behavior on the part of your relative, and they may not even remember having done that. They may not even know what you're talking about, and sometimes they don't even know what they did. Dealing with these people, try to keep the long-term picture in mind and try to protect your own health. Understand the need to create some distance at times. It takes people sometimes years to really be able to accept that their loved one has a mental illness. But until you can accept this, you won't be able to help in a supportive way that is needed. If you keep trying to get the person to just snap out of it, then everybody winds up frustrated because they're not likely to snap out of it. Do everything possible to keep the unpredictability of the symptoms from wreaking havoc in your own life. These illnesses take an enormous toll on everybody who's around them. It's hard not to take the symptoms personally at times. But just when you start to take these symptoms personally, just think of holding a baby. We've all held a baby on our shoulder and patted it, and then it burps up on our shoulder while you're holding it. Does that make the baby bad? Does that make the baby spiteful? No, you just happen to be there, that's all. And that's the same thing basically here. Try to look at things from the sick person's point of view. Many of their same age friends have gone on to accomplish things that the ill person may now never be able to do. So comment on any even small signs of progress or improvement that you see. Things in life that the rest of us take for granted can be monumentally difficult for people with a mental illness. Things like walking into a room that already has people in it can be really difficult. Things like looking somebody in the eye can be very, very difficult. Things like being touched by somebody can be almost overwhelming. Everybody needs to have goals, but they must be realistic goals. Once you pare down your expectations to what is realistic, you can better see and better appreciate accomplishments. Let people do as much as they can for themselves. Try to ensure that they feel your love and support. And at the same time, establish a loving distance there. Sometimes you'll need that distance. Family members can often get polarized among themselves around the issue of how involved to be in some of these cases. So find the appropriate middle ground and give the person's current level of functioning an examination with regard to that. People with mental illnesses need structure. They need to live a structured life. The chaos and disorganization in their internal world needs a steadying influence in their exterior world. What you can do is provide a calm external reality that's consistent and that is predictable. They need to know what to expect from you, and they need to know what you expect from them. And I'm talking about simple daily routine. One night I was in an emergency room at a hospital with a family, and they had a Down syndrome daughter who was there in this emergency room. The father had been stricken with some heart trouble in the middle of the night, and we were all there for several hours through the night. All this Down syndrome daughter could say was, "I'm supposed to be sleeping right now. I'm supposed to be sleeping right now." She couldn't relate to anybody else's issues, what was happening to her dad or anything. It's just, "I'm supposed to be sleeping right now." Not her fault. This is just the nature of Down syndrome. She needs that simple daily routine, and she needs to stick to that. Many people with mental illnesses are much the same way. Sometimes it helps to put things into writing. You might have the person write a contract out, if they're able to do that, about what their daily routine is going to be. This is especially true if they live with you. Establish the consequences for breaking a rule in advance. Try to make the consequences relate to the rule to which it pertains. Make the punishment fit the crime. Consult the person when you're deciding ahead of time what the consequences will be if a rule is broken. Don't try to develop consequences in the middle of a fight over them having broken a rule already. It's important that everybody knows what the rules are ahead of time and what's going to happen if the rules are not followed. And then follow through on what you decided, because your credibility depends on that. The more we understand about how people with mental illnesses process information, the better we'll be able to communicate with them. Be simple, be brief, limit your output, don't necessarily expect rational discussion, and don't take words or actions personally. People with mental illnesses often take things that are said quite literally. Sometimes somebody will say to a person with a mental illness, "Do you think you could make your bed?" And the answer will be, "I don't think about my bed." Because you put the word "think" in the sentence. Or they'll say, "Of course I could make my bed. It's just an abstract question. It has nothing to do with actually making their bed. They know they have the ability to do it." So it's much better to say, if you want to make their bed, much better to say, "Please make your bed." Four words can't be very well misunderstood. Say how you will feel if that person does what you are asking. "It would be a great load off my mind if you would take your medicine each morning." Avoid stockpiling resentments inside yourself until some little thing causes you to explode. Gently but firmly say that when you don't clean up the dishes, "I feel angry about that. After you make yourself a sandwich, I would feel better if you'd put everything away and wipe off the counter." Simple statements like that. Tell what the person did, tell how you felt about it, tell how you would like him to behave in the future. People with mental illnesses are often unable to clearly communicate what they need. They're unable to communicate clearly what it is that upsets them. So pay attention to their behavior and pay attention to their emotional state. There's such an enormous variation in individuals who have mental illnesses that it's really almost impossible to generally talk about it. I had a friend that had a heart attack, and when he was in the hospital, the doctor said to him, "Now tell me how you felt as you were having this heart attack." And he explained to him how he had felt. And the doctor said, "I want you to remember that, because that's the way you have a heart attack. The next time you have one, it's probably going to feel the same way." But other people will have a heart attack in a different way or with different feelings. Similarly, each case of mental illness is unique. There is a recognizable pattern, though, for each person. If you get to know that pattern for that person, then you can intervene early when needed. Seeing somebody that you love suffer from a major mental illness is painful and can be terrifying. It's been known to shake people's firmly held convictions about religion or morality or the meaning of life. People can spend years trying to understand why these things happen and attempting to find meaning or attempting to make some sense out of the situation. I've known people that literally laid in bed blaming themselves for not having done things differently, and then maybe the person wouldn't have gotten a mental illness. If we had a nickel for every sleepless night that's been spent by a relative of a person with a mental illness, we'd probably have enough money to find the cure for it. It's hard to see a young adult struck down before they even reach their prime. Parents see their child's life becoming so much less than they wanted it to be, and they've lost the son or the daughter that they once had. But yet every time they see that person, they're reminded of their previous potential. So there's a great sense of helplessness here in this. Family members may have differing ideas about how to handle the situation. To end, major mental illness is an enormous loss. And dealing with it includes the accompanying grief. It takes a lot of time, a lot more time than you would like. It takes longer than you think it will, and it takes longer than you think it should. But mental illness is indeed an illness. This is different from demon possession. In the fourth chapter of the book of Matthew, verse 24, we have demon possession mentioned, and we also have lunacy mentioned right in the same passage. These two different things mentioned, showing that they are different. Let me tell you quickly, if you want to know, how demon possession, which is often confused with mental illness, differs from mental illness. When people were demon possessed, they would always reason rightly on right grounds. They knew more than they would have if they hadn't been demon possessed, because they knew what the demon knew, or those words came out the person's mouth. Jesus, thou son of David. How they knew who he was. They'd been in heaven with him before they were cast out. So demon possessed people were of that nature. But mentally ill people reason wrongly on right grounds, or reason rightly on wrong grounds, or they get the two of those confused. It's a completely different phenomenon, although they superficially could sometimes present in a similar manner. But mental illness is indeed an illness, and we should see it as an illness. And you very often don't know how hard to push the person because you don't know what the person is actually capable of. You certainly cannot live somebody else's life for them. Anytime I wish that I could live somebody else's life for them, I try to look at my own life and see how well or how poorly I'm doing there. And then I decide I've got a full-time job just trying to live my own life the right way. I really shouldn't be trying to try to live somebody else's life. Loving a mentally ill person is definitely an opportunity to learn. It's an opportunity to practice patience. It's an opportunity to grow as a Christian in these areas. We need to balance love and concern with a healthy dose of detachment and live in hope. Well, it may or may not have been a good idea to look into this area today. You can decide personally whether you think it was or not. I didn't know whether to do it or not. In fact, when George called yesterday and asked about a reading for today, I didn't know what to tell him because I didn't know whether I had the guts to talk with you about this issue. But I thought, since there's a few of us here, maybe this might be helpful, and especially for those who deal with this in relatives. And I hope it hasn't been unduly distressing for anyone. If it was, I apologize. We're going to conclude this morning, or this afternoon, by extending the Lord's invitation once again. If you are subject to the call of the gospel in any way, or if you have anything to bring before the brethren here, let us know how we can assist you today by coming forward as we stand and sing the invitation number.